It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. This is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. Star Trek Beyond came out last week. It's a really interesting film. Took me by surprise. My expectations were low. Wanted to talk to somebody about it, so I called up our resident Seattle Trekkie, Bill Monroe. Bill's always a fascinating discussion. This is no exception. So let's talk Star Trek.
I thought it was a good, solid movie. I did not think it was a great... I did not think it was really a Star Trek movie, but I thought it was a good sci-fi movie with a couple of issues. Some related to characters, some related to pacing, and some requiring, you know, more suspension of disbelief as far as some hooks in the plot, but that's okay. I think it was solid. I think it was so much better than the second movie in the J.J. Abrams family, and a day after I saw it, I still liked it, so it's a winner.
That's good. Well, I saw it today, so I can't judge from the day after, but I think I liked it more than you. I really loved it. I don't think it's the best Star Trek movie. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. It's not Wrath of Khan, Voyage Home, or First Contact.
Right, right.
But there were a couple of times where it occurred to me, I was like, oh, this is what Insurrection thought it was.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, but I think in a lot of ways, it's the best of these three. And I loved the first one because I thought J.J. Abrams kind of went into the franchise with a crowbar and kind of he kind of broke it open because a shell had grown over Star Trek.
Right.
Basically from Voyager on, where it was only talking to the hardcore fans and it was shedding casual fans every year to
sure.
the point where Enterprise was no longer profitable. There weren't enough people watching it.
Right.
And JJ did a great job of cracking it open and going, well, here's all the things that are cool about Star Trek. And that got us all very excited. I remember it was the only movie Renee really liked. I was really confident about where the franchise was going. And then Into Darkness just... I felt like J.J. had run out of what he liked about Star Trek in that first film.
Right.
And he was kind of making a film that he thought Star Trek people would like. So he was like throwing in Tribbles and kind of mangling Wrath of Khan to do it again and bringing back Leonard Nimoy. And I felt like go ahead.
It was kind of, you know, Into Darkness, it was kind of a blender of fan service where they just threw everything in there and just turned it into mush.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of Peter Jackson's Hobbit, where you can tell, oh, this guy likes the franchise, but he's not really crazy about this.
Right.
And he's trying to turn it into something that he will like and trying intellectually to tell us what we like. And I tried to watch Into Darkness actually yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't finish it. Partially because we had a podcast to do and I didn't have enough time. But sure. Honestly, after the podcast, I didn't go back.
Right.
So this film, I had very low expectations for. First of all,
sure.
Since the second one was a letdown, the fact that we know we're getting a new series, which made me feel like this movie franchise was a dead end. And they were just kind of trying to wrap it up and get it out. The fact that J.J. left to do Force Awakens,
right.
And then Orci was fired, and they got a guy who did a couple of Fast and the Furious.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw that trailer of Captain Kirk riding a dirt bike.
Yeah. Yeah. The trailer really did not do service to the movie.
No, not at all. So I was going in thinking, well, maybe this will be pretty good. But then I talked to a couple of people, you being one of them, who said... Mm-hmm. It's actually good. So when I went today, I was amazed by how respectful it was to the franchise and how much it got the characters right. and how much it served them. And I think I give most of the credit to Simon Pegg, who wrote the screenplay for this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. And I think a lot of our core characters, I mean, they were treated well. And so I think they got the spirit of New Kirk, and they got the spirit of New Spock and New Scotty. I think they got all of that right. Where I think it was lacking, and I've begun to think about this, one of the common threads throughout the entire trilogy is that what this was lacking, this movie lacked a sense of wonder and awe of the universe, which just seems like the spirit behind much of traditional Star Trek, where even when, even in Wrath of Khan, which is just, you know, a straight up, you know, you think it's going to be a straight up revenge story, but we still get this whole sense of awe and amazement when we, you know, we start talking about the Genesis planet. And I think one of my problems with this entire franchise is that essentially all three of the movies have been a revenge story. It hasn't really had that sense of just pure exploration and the wonder and beauty of the universe. It's been about dealing with somebody who's, you know, upset that they've been wronged or perceive that they've been wronged, and they're going to do everything they can to get that right. And that feels like the common thread through there. And without that sense of awe, I think that's what really what separates it from a traditional amazement that Star Trek can invoke.
Yeah, the closest we get to a sense of awe, which I really liked, was the way they handled the space station, which we've never seen in Star Trek before. When they show that it's this kind of this glass force field sphere, and things are, and gravity is localized, so right. There are things on every plane. My first reaction was, "Wow, this really isn't Deep Space Nine." My second thought, and I took Ben with me. I leaned over to him and went, "This would be really cool in 3D." But I agree with you. It's not a big sci-fi idea that carries the plot. It's a location.
Right.
So it's more of a smaller thing. I will argue with you a bit about the revenge tactic is when you look at the Star Trek films, not the series, but when you look at the films, most of those villains are based in revenge. Of course, you have Khan, but you have Kruge in 3. You have the conspiracy in 6. You have the Borg Queen in First Contact. You have Sauron in Generations, although Sauron's more of an end justifies the means to get what he wants. But the aliens in Insurrection, Nemesis, most of the villains in the Star Trek movies have been motivated by revenge. So I wasn't. That doesn't bother me as much. And I thought Idris Elba did probably the best job of the three villains. And even going up against people like Eric Bana and Benedict Cumberbatch, I felt like his character had more to say and he did more with it. And I liked the fact that in the third act, I was thinking, well, what's my problem with this movie? And I thought, oh, the villain doesn't have any motivation. And then spoilers, that's the twist at the end of the third act.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, they tied that knot.
Right. You know, now, and that, again, he did a great job with that character. I think we did not see enough of that character's journey, enough of that process. And again, when we're talking about the spoilers and obviously let's get right into those spoilers then. I think that big twist, I caught that twist a lot earlier in the movie. That was what was happening, just because the uniforms were just so reminiscent of Enterprise.
Yeah, which I liked because they've made such a hard turn to split it off from the original television franchise, and that's what they've been calling it the Prime Universe to distinguish it from the new Brian Fuller series that's coming. And now we know there's going to be a fourth film in this series, so we're kind of where we are with say DC, where Justice League and Batman versus Superman is not going to cross over into Supergirl and Flash and Arrow.
Right.
We have two separate universes. And in fact, not to derail this off of Star Trek, but I don't know if you've seen, they've shown pictures of the Superman that will be in Supergirl, which is absolutely not Henry Cavill, and he's not wearing the same suit. So it's a clear... So fans of Supergirl are very excited. But it's big for the DC television universe because, you know, we have a Flash that appeared in Batman vs. Superman and that will be in Justice League. But the TV universe is saying, we have our own Superman, which means we have our own Batman.
Right.
And we have our own Green Lantern. And mm-hmm. I feel like that's what Star Trek's doing now. So for them to say, hey, Enterprise happened and they were Makos, or that moment at the end, which made me cry, is when Zachary Quinto sees a picture of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Right. Yeah. And it was definitely nice tributes to Nimoy the way they handled that. It was very subtle and just, you know, as soon as, from the tying in both the beginning and the end of the film was just really nice and nice way of respecting the contributions Nimoy had made even, to this new franchise.
Yeah, I cried immediately when they just showed the screen of that Ambassador Spock had died.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
As I said, I took Ben with me and he was reticent to go because he is not a Star Trek fan. I couldn't get anybody else to go. Renee couldn't find a babysitter and all my other friends had already gone.
Right.
So I was like, well, I could go alone. And honestly, I just didn't want to go to a movie theater alone. So mm-hmm. I kind of dragged Ben with me this afternoon. He really enjoyed it.
Okay.
He actually leaned to me in the middle during one of the space battles. And he goes, this movie's really good. I still don't like the show. I was like, you don't have to like the show. We can just enjoy this movie. You don't have to like everything. But that's it.
It's fundamentally different from the rest of what we know of as Star Trek.
Right. And these films have done a really good job of, if not bringing in the casual fans, at least mm-hmm. bringing them up to speed quickly.
Right.
You know, they're not forced out by the continuity of, 90s Trek. Which became so cross-cut. It was like X-Men comics in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as they showed Ambassador Spock, I just started crying. And I started thinking, I started thinking about the podcast we did a year ago to talk about the week that he had passed. Yeah. And I was like, I've already gotten over this. And I'm like, I don't want my son to hear me crying because I'm going to have to explain that I love this actor and I knew he died a year ago.
Right.
You're right. It was subtle and it was elegant. And those are two words I was not expecting from the director of Fast and the Furious. And after that first trailer, I was expecting a big, stupid movie to beat me over the head and with guys just wearing bell bottoms and T-shirts and calling it Star Trek.
Right. I think that choice that gave new Spock in terms of where he wants to take his career and his sense of obligation and the way it was resolved, I think that whole – I mean, that was very, very subtle, very elegant, but really gave him a very clean character arc and an opportunity to really define himself. What is this new Spock versus original Spock, and what are his desires? We already know the Vulcans are different in this universe. And
first of all, there's not many of them.
Yeah, well, sure, there's that. The fact that, being an endangered species now, but, just with the way they manage emotions versus the Vulcans that we've come to deal with. And I think the way that really set him on his path of decision making in a way that was just entirely appropriate, in a very subtle way, in the same way they did with Kirk and that scene with them in the elevator saying, yeah, we got to talk later. It's both comical and it really, at the same time, it really both sets them on, there's some very important stuff that's happening between these two. And they've each got to figure it out on their own and they do.
Yeah. And again, I loved the fact that, Justin Lin and Simon Pegg left these things unsaid. They didn't feel the need to hammer on it and put a button on it and do a little Easter egg and a callback. I loved that moment, as I said before, at the end of Spock going through, Ambassador Spock's things,
mm-hmm.
and also the same scene when Bones talks to Spock about Spock. And you can see there's no dialogue where Spock explains what Ambassador Spock means to him, because there's no way to explain it of like, this is my mentor and this is me, and there's a meta angle that this is the original character that I'm doing mm-hmm. an interpretation of, and that this is someone who is an icon that has passed. He plays all of it, and I loved the way he looked at that picture of the cast in Star Trek VI, and I thought it was so important that they used the cast shot from the last time they were all together, not from Wrath of Khan, not from the original series. That right. last moment. And there's a look on Zachary Quinto's face, and I don't know if it's open to interpretation or if just this is the way I personally took it, was that he both played it as my mentor lived a full life, and he played it as this is my crew 25 years from now. So right. these are the people that I need to be with for my life to mean something. And like, you know, it's almost mm-hmm. a Doctor Who moment of like, you know, you always say like, oh, you know, you and I met in 1988. We were just talking about this off the air.
Right.
And, you know, you always have that thought in your head. Oh, if we could go back then and tell each other, hey, and, you know, 25 years from now, you'll still be friends and you'll talk on a podcast. And then we have to explain what a podcast is.
What a podcast is, exactly.
And we'll live in opposite parts of the country, but we'll still get together. Right. You always have that fantasy. And here is Spock doing it.
Exactly.
Of going, wow, this is what my captain will look like in 20 years. And this is what I will look like in 20 years. Mm-hmm. But they didn't need to do it in a clever way.
Right.
You could just let it be.
And I think this is also an interesting contrast to The Search for Spock. In that movie, the theme behind that movie, we get a lot more. It's about the aging, and it's about, you know, looking back on your life and figuring out what you've done and, you know, what you're going to do with the rest of it, given the chance. In this movie, it's sort of that same time to look back at what you've been doing and where you're going to go, but it's less about aging and retiring towards the end. And it's more about looking at – it's more of a movie where this cast, these characters, grow up. This is really where they enter adulthood. Because even in the two prior movies, they were still sort of these fresh out of the academy, scrambling around, just figuring out what they're doing. By the time we're in this movie, they're already into their 5-year mission, and they're starting to figure this out. And question is, as they head into this, is what being a grown-up means. You know, does it mean going ahead and taking on other responsibilities? What responsibilities do you have to take on? And just in this movie, you know, Kirk and Spock and Scotty, they sort of do what Bones did from the first in the new franchise, and that's that they really get comfortable in their skin over the course of this movie.
Right. Well, this is a film about making decisions that will affect your life. I mean, Kirk and Spock do the obvious of that, but you're right, this is a film
where even Jayla does that at the end.
Yeah, where she decides to join Starfleet Academy. But I love the fact that they dealt with those heavy themes, and again, I keep coming back to subtlety, which was not a mm-hmm. word I thought I was going to use on this film. I loved that they touched on the themes of 2 and 3, and there are very direct references, but instead of Star Trek Into Darkness, where we have the death scene from Wrath of Khan, but it's actually Kirk who dies and not Spock who dies.
In Into Darkness, they flipped it and did all the stuff in such a way that it was sort of with a wink of, aren't we clever kind of way.
Yeah, and the thing that really killed Into Darkness for me is, I watched the moment again, is when Benedict Cumberbatch is called John Harrison until they capture him. Mm-hmm. And I paid extra attention to this yesterday, and he goes, my name is Khan. And it just gets quiet for a moment, and Kirk stares at him, and then they bring up this music sting. And it mm-hmm. really hurt that movie for me, because that was Star Trek Into Darkness saying, hey, right, Wrath of Khan, you like that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't and in fact, when I saw it with Steven, we did the podcast on it, he had not seen Wrath of Khan, so we had to watch it after Into Darkness for him to understand really what Into Darkness was saying, whereas these movies were supposed to be a fresh start for a new generation, this film was able to do that, where it's Kirk's birthday, just like it is in Wrath of Khan, and they're drinking together, he's drinking with Bones.
Right.
Just like in Wrath of Khan, but it's not about, oh, I'm getting older. We blow up the Enterprise right away.
Exactly.
But it's not that sad, oh my God, we destroyed the ship. I kept thinking of that line in Futurama. You know that episode of Futurama that the entire original cast is in?
Yes.
Yeah, and where they have to read the fan fiction from the cloud.
Yes.
And William Shatner goes, my ship, whom I love like a woman, is disabled.
Right.
And there is nothing about that. They don't care about the ship.
And we don't care about the ship throughout the entire new series, new storyline. We just don't care. We don't have that emotional attachment to the Enterprise that we did in the original series movies that made that moment so powerful in those movies. In part because, I mean, that was the same ship from the original series, and right.
Even though
movies,
it wasn't, it was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and even as we look at it in the other Next Generation movies, yeah, we cared about the D getting blown up. We really didn't care what happened to the E.
Right. Yeah. When the E looked like it was going to blow up in First Contact, it was, oh my God, they'll all be stranded in the past. And
exactly.
And that's what happened here was, wow, they're stranded on this planet.
Right.
You know, and it's a better crash sequence than we had in Generations.
Right.
The Generations crash sequence does hold up. It's not like a dated effect, but this was Titanic in scope. But mm-hmm. yeah, again, we don't love this ship because we're not told over and over and over again that Kirk loves this ship.
Right.
We were
exactly.
told in the original series, and we just get on with it. And it's that kind of feeling, you know. And at the end, at the very end, when they do have Kirk's party, he mm-hmm. toasts and he says to absent friends, which is is what Kirk says at the beginning of Search for Spock. And every time that the original series like hammered home, these characters love each other and you love these characters, which always worked with us.
Right.
But this movie didn't have to do that, and you kind of felt it anyway. And it was almost a sense of discovery, like, oh yeah, oh, he said absent friends in three, but it's got a different tone to it. So the Easter eggs were all about tone and all right. about feeling, whereas in Into Darkness, it was like comic book Easter eggs, where it's like, oh my God, they called that guy Hank Pym, you know? Oh, look, Franklin Richards is on a computer screen. And Into right. Darkness was doing that, which, again, you're back to talking to the hardcore fans and
right.
not bringing in the new audience. And I thought this movie did a really good job. Mm-hmm. I was talking to one of my friends today who will actually be on a future podcast.
Okay.
And he was saying how you could go into this movie and not even have seen the first two Star Trek movies, much less anything else, and get everything you need. And yet,
yeah, very much so.
If you knew these characters, both from the other two movies and from, you know, the 79 episodes and six movies, there was that depth to it.
Right. Right. And I think the added depth, when we talk about how this movie started, I mean, in terms of setting the tone, with calling out that Kirk's birthday here is 1 year older than his father was when he died.
Yeah, and
we're really going into a new place here.
Right, and we keep going back to him losing his father, which is, have you heard what the premise of the fourth Star Trek movie will be?
No, I haven't.
So they announced it right before Beyond came out. And I, as I said, I was shocked because I assumed that the franchise was just going to go to this new show and that was it for the movies. But Chris Hemsworth is going to be in it. So the story is going to be Kirk going back in time to save his father.
Okay.
So from a studio perspective, hey, Thor is in our movie. Yeah. Come and see our movie. But when I had that in my head when I was watching with this, and I'm like, yeah, they're really playing those themes about this unresolved business with his father. So I could see that movie working. It's not like Star Trek has shied away from time travel stories.
And when they've done it well, it's been great. And when they've done it badly, it's really bad.
Yeah, but you could say that about every type of story.
Yeah,
you've
done.
You could,
that's true.
You could certainly say that about holodeck stories. Which sometimes are just time travel stories with a framing sequence.
Right, exactly. That's true. That's true. That makes me nervous, but...
Yeah, but we'll see. Like I said, they announced it at San Diego. I was simply shocked that it was even happening.
Right, right.
Because I thought, you know, what I would love to see what Orsi had planned for this. Like, how much of what we saw came from Orsi, because he wrote a script, he was getting ready to direct it, and they fired him.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? And he was always known as the guy at Bad Robot who was the devotee of Star Trek.
Okay.
So maybe he wrote a piece of fan fiction that audiences couldn't understand?
It's, you know, it, I mean, it's certainly possible. I mean, I want to say, you know, maybe he wrote, maybe we learn more about the Franklin. I mean, I think my main problems with this story, and maybe that was part of the original story, you know, ultimately they did a good job of telling the story of the main characters, but how they got from, I mean, how Crawl and Manus and everybody got from the Franklin crashing to where they are and their evolution into these and the changes they went through while apparently completely forgetting that the ship was still on the planet is something that kind of bothered me. And maybe it was in that script.
Maybe I it wasn't explicit, but I filled in the fact that Crawl, because he was draining energy from humans, began to look more and more human.
Mm-hmm.
Was a clear indication that his crew was just draining the life of aliens to keep going, and that they slowly morphed into these other aliens. He also clearly rejects the Federation and Earth in his last video. I think they didn't care anymore. I think the ship didn't work. When it crashed, it was intact, but it didn't work. And what Crawl wanted, or Edison, when he was still Edison,
mm-hmm.
he wanted the Federation to rescue him, and they didn't. And that's when he just said, screw the Federation. There are no people on this planet. This is our planet now. And basically, they were luring aliens in, killing them, and draining their energy to keep going. They didn't care about the Franklin because the Franklin didn't work. Now, Jal, was it Jal or Jayla? I'm thinking of Jal.
I think it's Jayla, but I could be wrong on the pronunciation. But, I mean, she felt the need to hide the ship.
Well, Jayla was the only survivor from her planet. Who, you know, her family was lured there and all killed.
Sure,
she was the only one to escape. She discovered the ship, and she was a good enough engineer to get the systems working, to get life support and the computers working.
Right.
But she couldn't get it off the ground, and she created enough of a cloaking device that, you know, Crawl's people didn't care about the Franklin. They didn't think it was going to fly again, and it wouldn't have flown again if Scotty wasn't there.
Right. So, you know, exactly. But suddenly this ship, not too far from where they are, just disappears when she turns on the cloak. I know I have to let it go.
There's a little bit. It doesn't bother me that much. I felt like it was clear in the fact that they no longer cared about being part of the Federation, mm-hmm. and they found that city of mushrooms. Which I couldn't tell if they were organically grown or if there were people that built that city and they killed them all. But I loved the look of it because you could see where they hacked into it and put staircases and power lines. So they, you know what? It's like Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe, or, you know, if it helps you, Gilligan's Island, or Lost, where the first few episodes, the first few chapters, they're trying to keep that ship together and make a home out of that ship. And then later they move into the island and build a new civilization for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think they slowly forgot about it over the years. They didn't care about it. And Jayla was just cloaking it just so they didn't see it again and be like, oh, yeah, that's our ship. And then find her and kill her.
Mm-hmm.
So I was okay with it. It wasn't explicit from what I found. I did love that, as we said, the uniforms looked like Enterprise.
Right.
The ship looked like the Bird of Prey in Star Trek IV. And mm-hmm. I felt that was another subtle, elegant nod to, like, especially that transporter. That transporter mm-hmm. reminded me so much of There Be Whales Here.
Okay.
I felt like design wise, it was a nod to, like, hey, you remember that movie where, you know, and
okay,
and Star Trek IV was the movie that proved you didn't need the Enterprise to make a good Star Trek movie.
Right. Very, very true. Very true. You know, I keyed in more with me with being very reminiscent of the transporter on Enterprise.
Oh, yeah, because they didn't want to use it much.
It was still all experimental technology. And you know, and even when you've got Scotty saying, well, really, we really only want to use it for cargo, but we'll try it for people.
Yeah.
I did
think that either most of the Enterprise crew was killed or this Enterprise doesn't have a lot of people, because they were able to beam up people even 20 at a time. They beamed the whole crew back in about 5 minutes.
Right. Well, I got this.
And we never saw them again.
Right. Well, we know the only crew who would have made it. We know we had crew evacuating in escape pods, and many of those getting caught. We had, if you weren't in the saucer section, well, by the time we get to the saucer section, all that's left is the bridge crew.
Right, although the next section, crashing. Uhura's in the next section.
Uhura's in the next section.
And she
next
survives,
section.
Because she's and I think a lot of people get sucked out into space. We do see a lot of people go into space.
Exactly. And I think the complement of this Enterprise, I want to say it was only, you know, I suppose we could actually look this up, just over 100 or so. I don't think it was even as big as the TOS crew of 416 or whatever that was.
439,
yeah. So it was a smaller crew to begin with, which does make some more sense.
Yeah, although as I said, we don't see the other crew much, but and we were mentioning how the characters were given their due. I really liked in Act Two where we had four storylines going, and they were all equally balanced, and we got to see everybody really well. So yeah, we had Kirk's story, but then Spock and McCoy are together. Sulu and Uhura are together. Scotty's with Jayla. Chekov is with Kirk.
Right.
And everybody gets enough to do, which is one of the things the cast loved about doing Star Trek IV, was that they each had their moment to shine, which we haven't we have not had in the movies before. In the J.J. Abrams movies, you know, the guys got to do their catchphrases and get out. You know, the first film, Chekov gets to say Wictor. You know,
right. Well, I thought in the first film they did a good job of highlighting each of the characters and giving them their moments.
Yeah, but it wasn't as balanced as this film. This film, I feel like each of the characters got their own story, which hasn't happened before.
Okay, I guess in the first film it was really more about giving them their good introduction.
Yeah. The first film is about Kirk and Spock. It's not Spock even about McCoy. Spock. It's about Kirk. It's about Kirk and Spock, and then kind of check. Maybe Uhura. Uhura has a lot to do. And then checking off the other characters are like to make sure we know who they are and that they're true to who they were. But whereas in this, everybody has water to carry in the plot. And everybody does something to help the outcome. And you know, when we get to see them all on the bridge together and working together, there's a lot of great teamwork in this, which we haven't seen before.
Right, there is. There's a lot of and Sulu had a real nice role in here. We see, you know, there's actual value in a pilot.
Right, and you know, there was some controversy a couple weeks ago that they announced they made Sulu gay, and then George Takei had a problem with it.
Yeah,
which I found ironic. I posted it on the Facebook page. It was like, you know, the only reason they picked this character to be gay is because George Takei is gay, and George Takei is like, well, Sulu isn't gay.
Exactly. You know, and you know, I can kind of understand that. I mean, they're, you know, it's sort of like they're choosing to make the character gay because, hey, you know, as a tribute to a gay guy, instead of letting it come out of the character himself. You know, at the same time, the whole gay Sulu storyline, you know, it's, again, as you said before, subtle. And that is, that
it's
connection
a
is so
shot.
Subtly made.
It's
yeah,
a single
exactly.
shot of like, He meets a man and a child in the space station, and as they're walking, they put their arms around each other, and that's it. There's not a line of dialogue. Again, there's a lot unsaid in this film. So
right.
I was like, fine, let's move on. And it looked like, oh, can you remind me, do you know if the child was a little girl?
Yes, she was.
And that tracks with Generations, because remember, Sulu's daughter is on the bridge of the Enterprise B.
Right,
so
right.
You could have all of that.
Yeah, and then they cut to another scene later on where we see, again, Sulu's significant other and their child during the attack on the Yorktown.
Right. Yeah, so I had no problem with that. And even George Takei's solution was, why didn't you just create a new character and make them gay instead of retrofitting it on an existing character because it's not organic? But I think had they done that, everybody would be like, oh, now here's your token gay guy.
Right. And at the same time, there was nothing in either of the previous movies to indicate that Sulu was not gay.
Right. And honestly,
it was just a topic that hadn't come up.
Yeah, both in John Cho's portrayal and George Takei's portrayal.
Like, right.
You know, in Shore Leave, he's walking around with girls, but there's nothing really romantic in it.
Well,
then in Generations, we find out that he had a family and he had a daughter, but nobody said he had a wife.
Right, but they did keep playing. You know, occasionally you would see the, and of course this is the racist element of it, of some of the subtle racism as they even try to be more diverse. Of, you know, they always tried to just play it at, play the tension between him and Uhura more up.
Yeah, but that could very much be a girl and her gay friend.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it read like that in the movies.
Yeah, maybe. There
was always something unrequited. And let's put the two non-white characters together.
Yeah. Well, remember in 5, they like made Scotty and Uhura a thing?
I think what we're saying is they really needed more women on that bridge.
Yeah, one is not enough. And you know what? Nurse Chapel and Yeoman Rand have never appeared in these films.
Well, yeah, that's true. Of course, Majel Barrett did.
Oh yeah, yeah.
She was still the computer before she passed.
She was still, yeah, and yeah. Obviously, we're too far gone to use that old audio,
right?
Especially if you've written new dialogue for the computer, and that computer gets smashed, and then Franklin doesn't have audio,
right?
Yeah. I thought there were nice there were nice nods, even the. Even the rock music, I remember a friend of mine who's another big Trekkie, was complaining about that trailer, the trailer we saw, which is Kirk on the dirt bike, which does happen,
right? Right, yeah.
But you know,
it's, you know, and I'll say this: I'm like okay with that. It's in character since we saw him stealing a car as a kid to go fast. I mean, I have no problem buying that this Kirk would do that. I think what we also see is this, unlike Shatner Kirk, this Kirk has an extra spark of having fun while he's doing what he's doing.
Right. And we see Kirk riding a motorcycle in 1 when he sees the Enterprise being built.
Yeah.
And also the song, because when the trailer came out and people were complaining about the dirt bikes, and he was like, yeah, and they're just blasting the Beastie Boys in Star Trek. And I reminded him, that's the same song that he plays when he's stealing the car.
Mm-hmm.
And again, subtle. This movie's so subtle in so many ways.
When, you know, and
when
you
they put it
you're...
on, he just kind of smiles and he goes, good choice. Because he's remembering being a kid and stealing that car.
You know, and that's what's, I guess that's one of the things that's really amazing. When you think this is a big blockbuster movie. This is a movie, we're talking a lot about subtlety and character, but this is a movie with giant space battles that go on for quite a while. With big effects, big explosions, you know, big battles, and the theme that we come away talking about it is it's subtle.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of the big battles, I was really impressed. I mentioned already, I love the design of the space station. And then they use that localized gravity.
That is a starbase.
Yeah. And
that's what a starbase always should have been.
And also the ships that work like nanites. I leaned over to Ben in the middle and I was like, those ships are like Big Hero 6. And he's like, yeah, except they can fly.
Uh-huh.
We've never seen in Star Trek before. And they eat the Enterprise into pieces.
Yeah.
There's no, like, they're firing phasers and then like, we can't fire phasers at a snowstorm. And that shot where they're driving into it and it becomes a tsunami.
Yes.
And then they turn on the Beastie Boys and break it up.
There
are big, big action sequences in it, but one of the other things I appreciated about these action sequences is when JJ did the first Star Trek, and we see that first ship, the first shot where we go underneath the Kelvin, and it spins around, and then it goes up against the Romulan ship.
Mm-hmm.
I remember saying at the time, oh my God, this is what Star Trek looks like with a Star Wars budget, because they've always been mid-budget movies.
Right.
And then, of course, then JJ does The Force Awakens and goes, oh, no. Like, you could not make my Star Trek if you could not make my Force Awakens for my Star Trek budget.
My Star Trek budget.
And I was
exactly.
Like, oh, yeah, it's a second class citizen again. But yeah. In this film, when I was watching the space battles, I realized they're not trying to be Star Wars anymore because they know they can't. This film, they tried to be Guardians of the Galaxy, and that's a goal they could nail.
Okay. Yeah.
And those battles were fantastic.
They really were. They really were. And I think what's really kind of interesting about that is it's also a commentary on just sheer strength doesn't matter. You know, it's those individual ships, they're very tiny, but they're just picking it apart a little piece, a little piece, a little piece here, a little piece there. You don't need, you know, one single strong thing is not going to take it apart. And the way you defeat that at the very end is all you have to do is communicate or stop them from communicating. And once you can mess up communication, that's where strength is. The strength really is in being able to coordinate and share and communicate among one another. And that's the key to success. In the beginning, the key to success for the small ships, and in the end, you know, the key to success for the Enterprise.
Right, and that's the word they keep using in the film is unity. And
right.
When he gets the MacGuffin, which is just, you know, seriously, it's just a MacGuffin.
Right.
When he threatens to kill Sulu and then the other crew member gives up the MacGuffin, he says, see, unity is not a strength. And yet he is using a weapon that is 1,000 little things that work together. But they're not individuals. They're drones.
Right.
And that's the interesting thing is he's using the idea of unity as his weapon while disparaging unity because he feels abandoned by the Federation.
Exactly.
But it is the people working together and adding their different ideas and doing different tasks that is what wins over.
Right. So what did you think of Ensign Syl using her head fingers to hide the thing?
I'm always glad when we see an alien in Star Trek that isn't a rubber forehead. Like, I really, in the first J.J. Abrams film when there was an alien that just had bigger eyes that were just CG manipulated. I love, you know, the little Deep Roy alien that's in all three. It's kind of sidekick.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that
we're
expanding the universe beyond Klingons and Romulans and Cardassians and Ferengi. You know, because in the 80s and 90s, and honestly, if we're talking about the period of Star Trek, we're not talking about the 60s. We're talking about the 90s. You know, the original cast is making movies, and Next Gen is on, and Deep Space Nine is on, and Voyager is about to launch. That's the peak of Star Trek.
Right, when everything is firing all at once.
Yeah, and with the technology and the budget they could do was they could apply a lot of prosthetics to people. And
right.
We saw many, many races, a lot of whom are my favorite because of what they did with the characters. But I love when we go and explore something else. And she had a reverse, like, face hugger on the back of her head.
Right. Right.
And I thought that was cool. It kind of was a little Men in Black-ish for me. Did you see Men in Black 3?
No, I didn't. I know I should see it at some point, but Men in Black 2 was so, so bad.
It's really bad. Men in Black 3 is really solid. It's fun.
Okay.
And you can kind of like Ghostbusters, where, you know, one's a classic, two is garbage, third one's pretty good.
Okay. Yeah, I still do want to see the third one. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah, Jemaine Clement plays the evil alien in that, and he had kind of a tendril thing going on, so it reminded me of that.
Okay.
So, but I thought it was a nice twist. It would have been better had we seen that character before, and it would have been more of a surprise. Instead, we look at an alien, and then she just does that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think. I mean, not to, you know, at any time I start, we start drifting into these kinds of concepts here, I am always a little, it's always with a little trepidation, but my concern here is that yes, it was clever, but at the same time we have a female character introduced for the sole purpose of hiding something inside her body.
Yeah, and then we kill her off.
And then we kill her off when that's revealed. And that just there's something uncomfortable about that.
Would it have made you feel better if it was a male character?
It might have, given everything that we've been talking about over the last several years, especially in terms of the portrayal of women in media and stories, and the idea of having, you know, and it takes more to have an empowered female character than just, you know, replacing a male character with a female one and giving her powers. I think if that character had been male, it would have struck me as less exploitative.
That's really interesting, and I could go down the rabbit hole of this topic, except that have you heard about the controversy about the Batman animated Killing Joke feature?
No, I haven't.
They showed it at San Diego, and a lot of people were very upset because of just this topic. And that is coming on next week's episode. We've already recorded it, and that's pretty much all we talk about.
Well, I will definitely look forward to that one.
Yeah, empowering female characters.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Uhura's very empowered in all three of these movies, but you're right.
Absolutely.
She's the only one. And, you know, in Next Gen, we at least had two women.
Right. Well, and at the same time, even in this movie, you know, one of the keys to success is that Spock unintentionally planted a tracker on his girlfriend.
Right, and nobody thought it was cool.
Yeah, exactly, and they did call that out. You know,
although,
which,
you know, just, the new character is a female, and she's very much the opposite of what we got in Alice Eve and Into Darkness,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, we have our seven existing characters, a few of which don't really get to do anything in Into Darkness, and then we bring on a new character who does everything and then strips to our underwear for no reason.
Right, right.
So we don't have that in this.
Right, very much. Very true.
Yeah, no one's really sexualized in this movie, at least.
Right, right. You know, very, very, very true. You know, I would like to have seen more of Jayla's story, mm-hmm. and her path from going from you know, runaway, or escapee rather, to becoming this incredible fighter and engineer to on her own, to then making the decision to join Star Trek or Starfleet rather. And I think there's some interesting stuff in her story. I would have liked to have seen more of it.
Well, with a fourth movie coming, we could always bring her back.
We absolutely can. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, I think we're should wrap up soon.
Sure.
Obviously, I think we're both in agreement. But yep. How do you feel about where the overall franchise sits now with this third movie behind us, a fourth movie coming, and a new series coming? How are you feeling about Star Trek in general?
I'm feeling very good about Star Trek. Everything I've been hearing lately about the new series, I really like. I'm feeling optimistic about that, especially since my understanding is that now it's going to be on streaming on Netflix as well instead of just the CPS streaming service, which I think would have killed it.
Oh, is it? I
haven't read too much in detail about that, but I've been starting to see more and more headlines and more commentary on that. So if that's the case, that's awesome.
That's interesting because I just read that about Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's starting to realize, you know, you can go ahead and build the whole thing, or let's just get it out. Let's get it out there, and I think that's going to be great from making it accessible.
Right,
I also,
as much as I'm willing to pay for these products, I just don't really have the mental bandwidth to go, all right, I'm going to pay $6 for Mystery Science Theater and go to their website, and then I'm going to pay $8 to CBS and go to their website, and then maybe they have an app that shows it on my TV, or maybe my laptop's sitting with me.
Right.
To know that it's just on Netflix. I actually got, I'm as unhappy with Comcast as everyone else in the universe. But they just announced that in 2017, Netflix will be a channel. So I think when you go to that channel for the first time, you'll have to put your account and your password in. You're not going to get free Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
But Netflix is going to become as easy as going to Comedy Central now.
Okay.
That you can just flip over to Netflix and then get to your queue. And knowing that all of these things that are going to be exciting and streaming will live there,
mm-hmm.
Makes me really happy. So this is the first time hearing that Star Trek will be on Netflix.
If that's true, that would be excellent. Just trying to scan the internet. I suppose I should read this later. I'm afraid that now I may have been a little too optimistic, and they may be Netflix may be carrying internationally, but not domestic.
Well, Netflix already has all of the other series. They tend to rotate the movies. They've never had all 12.
Sure.
But they always have like two or three.
Right.
So.
Still, I'm optimistic about the new series. I'm also, this movie has really made me optimistic about this movie franchise. I think they did they've told a really nice three movie arc. I like where we're seeing the characters now. It feels like they have a good footing onto them, and they know what they can do in the future. That time travel stuff works out awesome. But I think this is this I mean, this new Star Trek, I still don't feel it captures the sense of wonder and awe that we got out of our traditional Star Trek franchise. But this movie is a great movie on its own outside of Star Trek. And I think if they can continue in that, I mean, this won't be Star Trek, but it will be a great franchise on its own. And I'm confident in that.
Yeah, I agree. Just to check up on what we were saying about Netflix, what I'm reading now is that CBS's streaming site is not available outside the U.S., so outside the U.S. it'll be on Netflix. But in the U.S., it will be exclusively on CBS. We do know that the pilot episode is going to air on the network.
Sure.
And it'll be the only episode that will be on network television, and basically it's going to be a promotion to get you to go to the CBS streaming site.
Okay. But so before then, I just have to set up a Canadian VPN. Got it.
There you go. Yeah, but it's going to be a 13-episode arc. So mm-hmm. which we have never had in Star Trek before. Because even in the days of the Dominion War or the Zindi on Enterprise, we were still having self-contained episodes, and the overall arc was
right.
More. We've never had a chaptered story for more than two episodes in Star Trek.
Well, and that reflects the broader trend of streaming, which we've all talked about before, is that prior to streaming, all episodes, their second life was going to be in syndication and popping up out of order, so you had to have all those standalone episodes. But now with streaming, most people are not watching this stuff out of order, and it's not just popping up at random. You're making a decision to sit down and watch them, so we can do all of those much longer arcs, and we don't have to have all of those standalone episodes anymore.
Right. And yeah, that trend began with once DVD season sets came out, and
right.
And then you realized there was a way for you to not miss an episode.
Right. But even when DVD season sets came out, that was the start, but most people still weren't buying them because that was such an investment to go ahead and buy the series on DVD or to trek down to the video store to rent the DVDs. But streaming has really changed all of that.
Yeah, streaming has accelerated to the point where I get in discussions all the time with people of why I'm still buying discs.
Right.
and part of me thinks I shouldn't be. I just bought...
If it's something you want to watch more than once or twice, buy the disc, because the streaming services will take stuff away.
That's exactly how I feel.
We've seen Amazon take books off of people's Kindles that people thought they owned.
Well, the last season set I bought was Doctor Who season 9, mm-hmm. Which is still not available on Amazon Prime. It's no longer available on Netflix. Because it went to Amazon Prime.
Right.
And they don't have it. And you know what? When I watched it a second time, I fell in love with Doctor Who all over again.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm pulling out the discs of the other ones that I do have on Amazon Prime.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I am that particular type of fan. I have lots of long boxes in my basement.
Yep.
I know there will come a day where these discs will no longer be available. And there will come a day where these players are not readily available to get at Best Buy. And
right.
I'm trying to decide what to do about that.
Well, last week, the very last VCR rolled off the assembly line.
I saw that, yeah, from Japan.
Is news. And in the other news, people were still building VCRs last week.
Up until 2016.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, yep. I found some videotapes over the last couple weeks of short films that we've made, some of which are notorious around our circle of friends, that I realized I have to have transferred to DVD, and when I transfer them to DVD, I'm gonna have to ask for an MPG file of it, because just a DVD's not gonna cut it anymore.
Right.
So I gotta YouTube these things. But Bill, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @training_Bill.
Great. And anything new? We won't do a formal greatest thing in the world, but is there something you're into right now that's not Star Trek related?
I will say the next movie I intend to watch at home is going to be The Martian, because the book is a couple years old, The Martian by Andy Weir. If you have not read The Martian, go read it. About an astronaut who gets stranded on Mars and then adventures ensue. Incredibly well told, with a deep respect for the science and physics that's involved, which is the sort of stuff just out my grasp, but I buy it. I read this book in like 4 sessions, and it's just incredible. If you haven't read The Martian, you know, after you're done listening to your podcast, go find it. Go buy the book. Go download it. Go find it someplace. The Martian is a fantastic book.
That's great. The last good – I'm reading a book which I'm not enjoying tremendously right now, so I won't even bother mentioning it. But it's a big, it's a big book that everybody kept recommending to me, so I'm not going to trash it.
But do you want to put a warning caveat on it if you pick that up?
Nah.
Okay.
You know what? If somebody comes on the show and brings the book up, I'll be like, ah. But the last really great book I read is the new Chuck Klosterman, But What If We're Wrong? I'm a big fan of Klosterman. I've been reading him for the last 10 years, and I haven't read all of his books, but this is probably his deepest book yet. It's about history. And he starts off saying, you know, Copernicus and Aristotle were sure that gravity was caused because things want to be connected to the Earth. So if you dropped a rock, it fell to the Earth because it was part of the Earth. And people believed that. Until Isaac Newton came around, and then people went, Aristotle doesn't know what he's talking about. So then he extrapolates that and he goes, what are the things that we all believe now that we won't believe in 100 years?
And interesting.
It's really interesting because he's a pop culture writer usually. So he does talk about things. He mentions that people didn't care about Moby Dick for the first 75 years of its publication. And now it's considered a classic that everyone has to read. But when it was written, no one said you had to read it. And then he goes into, there's a chapter about in 300 years, what are we going to call rock music? Because we're only going to remember one band. And sure, it's going to be the Beatles. But then he's like, but what if it's Bob Dylan? And then he kind of talks about like what that would be. But he goes into things like science and politics. And he moves away from entertainment, and it's a really fascinating read. It's almost a book on philosophy,
okay,
and anthropology. I really, really enjoyed it. I love all of Klosterman's books, especially Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and I Wear the Black Hat. So if you finish But What If We're Wrong, I want to read more. Those are the two I would read first.
Yeah, Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs is the only one of his that I've read, and I really enjoyed that book too.
Yeah, definitely pick up I Wear the Black Hat. That's all about, he calls it villains both real and imagined, where he talks about, you know, he talks about like Darth Vader, but then he talks about Bernie Getz and NWA, and he comes up with theories of, and it seems like in that book, he comes up with two theories that he goes back to of villains are made by people who make a choice, and he does a whole thing on O.J. Simpson. People that make a choice that ends up changing the way people look at them, and then they spend the rest of their lives either combating that, which is O.J. Simpson looking for the real killers, or they lean into it because that's their claim to fame. That's another really good book, but this new one, But What If We're Wrong, goes much, much deeper even than that one.
Okay.
He's becoming a better writer. He was just on Marin a couple weeks ago, and it was a really interesting conversation.
Okay. Very cool. So sort of, you know, it just sort of makes you question everything and start looking at things. And anytime we can start questioning our assumptions, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. It's always good to read a book that does that to you.
Right.
So you've done your plugs, but you can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is our Twitter feed. You can follow us on our Facebook page. You can listen to us, subscribe through iTunes or through Stitcher. I think we're on Blueberry. I gotta look that up. I've said that a couple of times. I know I've submitted it. Or you can listen to every episode we've ever made, including the 22 of them that Bill is on, since 2012 on caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com. And Bill, I always enjoy talking to you. Thanks for calling from Seattle.
You're very welcome. It's always a blast.
Hey guys, before we go this week, I just wanted to give you an update on our old friend David Redfield. Now, you know Dave, he's been on the show dozens of times. He's always really fun. He's always really insightful and one of the sweetest guys in the world. Well, he just had an operation yesterday. He had kidney disease stage 3. Guy lost about 40 pounds in a month. We were all really worried about him, but he's doing great. He is recovering very well. So if you're a fan of Dave and you want to wish him well, just remember he is at David_Redfield on Twitter. Send him messages. Tell him that you hope he gets well and let him come back to the show soon. We all miss him and we can't wait to see him again once he's better. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that, meatball!